This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Most of us smile and show off our pearly whites dozens of times a day without thinking twice about it. But if we dig back into our old family photo albums, you will quickly notice that the happy smile has not always been such a common gesture. My guest today argues that a toothy grin is actually quite a recent phenomenon. It emerged in 18th century Paris and had a second resurgence in the early 1900s. The story of the modern smile spans art, literature, culture, and science. And Colin Jones documented the story in his recent book, The Smile Revolution in 18th Century Paris. Colin's a professor of history at Queen Mary University of London, but he's in the area this year as a fellow at the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park. He's going to give a lecture about the history of the smile tonight at 5, but we have him in our studio now. Colin, welcome. Good to have you here.
Yeah, nice to be here.
So it seems odd to think about somebody writing about the history of this gesture, which we think of as so human and so natural, but as it's recorded in portraiture, it's not common at all, or at least in earlier history, right?
Yeah, that's right, absolutely. And I must say this is a story I stumbled into in that I was working on a general history of medicine in the 18th century, looking at the way in which that was experienced by individuals. And I came to realize that an important change was happening in the way people thought about teeth and their problems with their teeth. And we're passing from an age of tooth pulling, where you have a problem with your teeth, pull it out, to one in which people actually think proactively about their teeth. They want to protect their teeth, to keep their teeth. And then just at that same time, I was thinking, that's an interesting story. I came across this portrait right at the end of the 18th century done by a woman called, female artist called Madame Vigée Le Brun. And it's presented in the Louvre, at the Salon in the Louvre. And it shows her smiling, beautiful smile. It's on the cover of my book, and showing white teeth. And I thought, well, that's interesting already. But then someone pointed out to me, a friend of mine pointed out, that that smile caused great scandal. And all the connoisseurs say, you know, this is absolutely disgusting that this woman is behaving in this extraordinary way. So I thought straight away, well, there is an interesting story. Something is happening here about the mouth, the teeth, the smile that I'd better investigate.
And what was happening was essentially the history of modern dentistry, which traces its roots to Paris.
Exactly. I mean, this passage from tooth pulling to dentistry, first the invention of the word dentiste in French comes dentist in English from the 1750s, 1760s, but also a branch of surgery which specialized in the teeth and looks after the teeth and tells people how to look after their teeth. It's precisely this moment in Paris in the middle of the 18th century to just give a sense of what's happening, that the toothbrush is born. The modern toothbrush emerges at this precise period.
In Paris, not all over Europe.
In Paris, and it spreads out. Obviously, other people start doing it. But right through to the early 19th century, in fact, the big toothbrush manufacturers are in Paris. So, yeah.
And we shouldn't take it for granted that a thing like toothbrushing is a fad that we'd catch on. It's still uncomfortable, but it does in Paris. So what's going on in Paris? Why Paris? Why is modern dentistry? Why is our consciousness about our teeth located there in the 18th century?
Yeah, this is a story which is about dentistry, and that's a very important component of it. But I think also what is important is the idea that people want to show white teeth and feel that a smile which shows white teeth is something good and positive. So it's about cultural norms and the expression of emotion and the way in which people relate to each other. And those are things which are happening particularly in Paris. Paris is the center of the European Enlightenment at this period. It's where there are the coffee houses, the salon, the meeting places, the gardens. Everyone wants to be there. And it presents new networks of sociability in which people come and try and talk and converse and reason and express their feelings with other individuals, but in a sense of, with a sense of greater equality, perhaps, than has been the case with the sort of public venues of sociability before, like the royal court, where everyone has to be very fixed and immobile in their expressions, and a smile will only be disdainful and sardonic or ironic and will always have the mouth closed. Suddenly, smiling in this new way, this new more sentimental way, a way more open to sensibility, becomes the way in which people want to express their feelings and their individuality, I think.
But talk about that polarity or that disparity, the idea that the court, the older idea, the pre-Enlightenment idea, was that reason and emotion were to be kept very, very far apart, and one should never show one's emotion if one were to prove and try to demonstrate how reasonable they were. These ideas come together in this moment of in this particular moment in Paris.
Absolutely. And what gave me the clue to the idea that something was happening again in this area about ideas and feelings was I actually used one of these big computer databases and ran the word sourire, smile, through it. What I found was in the most French literature through to the about 1730s and 1740s, very few smiles, first of all. And then when they happen, they're always sardonic or disdainful or contemptuous. Suddenly, they go shooting up. Lots and lots more smiles. And also, they are much more open. They're beautiful. They're real. They're human. They're natural. They're virtuous. And what seems to be the moment around which these things turn is the great novels of sensibility of the 18th century. So Samuel Richardson, Clarissa and Pamela. Bestsellers in England, but absolutely massive in France. But then also Jean-Jacques Rousseau as well with his Nouvelle Héloïse. Suddenly these propose a new way of thinking about feeling, which is rooted in a more egalitarian sense of humanity, but also is a humanity which isn't just a dry rationality, but a reason which is infused with feeling and passion. And these are very important authors, not just because of what they write, but they're read. These are bestsellers. Mm. People try to take that into their lives, to live. It's almost like they try and mime or echo the feelings and the expressions of their heroes, which they read about in the novels.
So in this moment, when we're sitting around the coffee houses talking about the new big ideas of what would be called the Enlightenment, the idea is to be fully human. We should engage with our emotions and the reason and have these conversations together, smile. So this is the moment we see. Now we're worried about our teeth, and now we start to have anxieties, which dentists can soon soothe about just how our teeth look, right? Because having a mouth job in Paris becomes an important thing.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that at this precise moment, in North America, you'll find this very difficult to believe, but Paris is the world center of good dentistry. So people who are on the Grand Tour, for example, going around the cultural sites, will often stop in on Paris to have their teeth done. When Marie Antoinette in Vienna, before she goes to meet and marry the future king of France, she gets a Parisian dentist to look after her teeth. And of course, in America, George Washington, even on campaign, he has problems with his teeth. He gets a French dentist, expatriate dentist, to look after him. So it is the place where you have great dentistry.
Not wooden, by the way, turns out.
No, I know there's a story
out.
About that.
It's a great story, sure. But it turns out not true. Yeah. That, to me, and the downgrading of Pluto are the two great sort of disappointments of my life. So more about this. And again, sugar plays a big part in this, too. Now we're in the colonial period, more sugar making its way to the continent.
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the things I thought was really counterintuitive about this story, that, you know, that in the 18th century, the open mouth, white tooth smile really comes on stream. And yet we know from cemetery evidence, archaeological evidence of skeletons in cemeteries, that if ever teeth were bad, up to that moment, it was then. It was probably the worst moment of a human teeth because, as you said, you've had colonial sugar flowing into Europe and, of course, to North America as well, producing a marked deterioration in people's teeth.
So this is all going on. Let's get back to that portrait that you talked about, the cover of your book. You can see it at our website, stateofthings.org, if you want to see this portrait. What was it that was so scandalous? Because you said this painting was done at the end of the 18th century, right? So by now we should be okay with this, but we're not in this portrait.
Yeah, I think in painting, the canons of the protocols, the rules about what you can show in a portrait are still very conservative. And essentially, most artists don't break the mold until Madame Vigée-le-Brun looks. And indeed, your listeners can check this out for themselves by flicking through any website or going to any art gallery. For a smile, an open mouth, shall we say, in Western art is invariably, just about always, negatively viewed. And it usually means the person opening their mouth to smile or make some sort of expression is plebeian, insane, or perhaps in a situation where their reason isn't totally in control, like they might be a child who hasn't attained the age of reason, or someone who's drunk in a tavern or something like that. Or alternatively, in the throes of some extremely strong emotion where, you know, the brow will be furrowed and the sort of mouth will be open, like horror or anxiety or angst or ecstasy or something like that. So Madame Vigée-le-Brun really does break the rule book, actually, by smiling in that way. And of course, once she's done that, becomes more acceptable. Although in the 19th century, you have a sort of retreat towards closed-mouthed, dignity, gravitas, and all the rest of it.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. That's another fascinating part of the story. Why this retreat in the 19th century?
I think that was the thing that I puzzled longest over completing the book, because it's clear that what you seem to have coming on stream by the end of, by 1780s, really, is that white tooth smile, which we see, we can identify. You know, we look on the TV or the billboards or whatever, it's there. So what happens to that smile? Why does it disappear? And ultimately, I think it's a lot of reasons, but probably the biggest one is the political passions of the French Revolutionary era, which make a smile an inappropriate gesture. You need to be committed. You need to be politically dominant. If you're Napoleon, you need to be, have that gravitas of a great, great ruler. A number of other factors tie into that. I mean, one of them is the decline of French dentistry. You get a reorganization of French medicine, and dentists lose out, essentially. So that Paris will never be a center of dentistry again. And also the emergence of the science of physiognomy, the shape of people's heads, in other words, and the bumps on their heads or the shape of their noses or their ears are seen as a better indication of true character and their true humanity than the changeable features of the face.
To what extent do we, because you talk about this convergence of reason and passion in what is the birth of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, often we think about that period as the time in which only, that rational considerations would lead to industrial capitalism, the idea that the only rational use for this land is the one that would have the highest dollar return. So is there a divergence there as well, that these two things that came together in Paris in the 18th century now diverge?
That's a very interesting point, in fact. And I think what I'm charting really is the emergence of forms of behavior which are modern, which are manifestly modern, which we see as modern, but in a period in which capitalism hasn't really made the sort of progress and put pressures on people's behavior and expectations as it will in the 19th century. And the 19th century face of the capitalist is the grad grind, non-smiling, it's only brass tacks sort of approach. So the smile will not seem appropriate for that. So as you say, it does fall out. The smile sort of falls down a hole of the 19th century and then reemerges right at the end of the 19th century, and particularly in the 20th century. And of course, the leader there is the United States of America.
So how does it make a comeback, and why the United States?
This is something I obviously had to try and take the story to forwards, and I think there's a lot still to be done. But for me, the crucial things seem to be the emergence of good dentistry, scientific dentistry. America is in the lead. It professionalizes much earlier than other countries, and it really is important. I think, secondly, advertising and commercialism, and the smile sells anything, sells you, it sells your product. And that you see that coming in very much in the interwar period. The other thing which I think is important, and which in some ways echoes what happened with the novels in the 19th century, is you get studio photography. Particularly in the interwar periods, you see all these great movie stars, Hollywood movie stars, and they're all showing their teeth. And that becomes something which people want to do. They want to, in other words, live the identity of their dream, if you like. They live the dream through their character, just as they did that through the heroes and heroines of the novels of sensibility in the 18th century. In the 20th century, it's the film star that people want to do. So the smile comes back with that.
Well, I think that's an important revelation in your book, the idea that we think that seeing a smiling face will always make us happy. So if you were ever to sell a product, you would always use a smiling face. But as you suggest, that wasn't always the face of seriousness. That wasn't always the face you wanted to imitate. So you have to do something to make you believe that that's what you want to imitate.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And I think it's very symptomatic of the moment of change, which, as I say, in the 20th century does seem to be the interwar period. It seems precisely in the 20s and 30s that people, when confronted with a camera, actually do that cheese thing. They say cheese so as to reveal their teeth. And allegedly by then, by that gesture, reveal the sort of their true character in some, their true identity.
But why do you suppose that changed? What was going on that made it possible for a movie star to say, I want you to like me, and instead of this old, dour, very serious intellectual, I'm going to be this guy or woman?
Well, you're asking a real question here, but I think it has to do with the way in which in modern capitalist society, these sort of dreams are sold, essentially. It's that people's expectations and aspirations become part of the system, if you like. And certainly, films, as we know, seize the imagination of you know generations, not just Americans, obviously, in that period, and the way that obviously the internet and all that comes from that is doing in the first part of the 21st century.
We are talking about the history of the smile today on The State of Things. My guest is Colin Jones. He's at the National Humanities Center right now. He's a fellow there, but he's written a book that talks all about the history of the smile. You can hear a lecture tonight at 5 o'clock and find out more at our website. It is interesting because if I look back at photographs of my great-grandparents, so this is end of the 19th century, right? They are not smiling, none of them. And I thought, oh, life must have been pretty tough for those folks.
I think photography is particularly interesting, in fact, because, of course, we have photography from the 1830s and 1840s. And you would expect a more spontaneous or sense of immediacy to come out of those, the portraits of photography. But I think that, well, two things. One is there are some technical problems because of the long exposure times. It's very difficult to keep a smile, as we know, in front of a mirror for more than a millisecond that looks genuine. So there is a technological. But in fact, that's solved, really, by the end of the 19th century. More important, I think, is that photography as a new art tries to follow the styles and the approaches of the existing high art. So they really copy the models of painting, of traditional portraiture. And so you have a sort of mimetic, you know, copying sort of phenomenon going on. And it's only really when you get snap photography, but also then these wider cultural changes in the early part of the 20th century that things really move on.
Of course, you're talking about changes in Western culture. Can we track this in non-Western civilizations?
I think it seems to be coming quite late, actually. Originally when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, well, this is a very Western phenomenon because you think of like the Japanese. Clearly, Chinese have a different sort of facial regime or smiling regime, we could think of it. But I gather, talking to friends, that maybe this is the spread of Western capitalism throughout the world, but now that type of U.S. smile, that sort of white tooth, beautiful smile, is becoming much more general now. So you look at girls having, young women having their photos taken in Tokyo or Beijing, they will much, much more frequently show white teeth than they ever have done before. So in some ways, the smile seems to be in very good shape.
Though, with the advent of the selfie and the duck face, we may see the end of the smile.
Well, do you know, this is something which I finished my book. I said the smile seems to be doing well. And then since then, I've suddenly realized there is this new phenomenon of the duck face, which someone had to explain to me, I should say. But it does seem to be linked to the selfie, as you say. What's fascinating that... As a number of people have said to me, if you're on a selfie, even with the wand of narcissism in front of you, when you smile, you know, your face fills up. You look like a Cheshire cat there, you know. So in other words, hollowing the cheeks, you know, producing that pout, in other words, becomes the way which will express something about the person. Of course, it's quite a sort of playful and cheeky sort of a gesture as well, which people quite like as well. Whether the duck face is just a blip, which will soon disappear, or whether it's the new future of personal identity and self-presentation, I don't know.
I think you'd have to do something to mark the fact that you're taking your own picture and not sort of emoting or reacting to somebody across, you know, on the other side of the lens. Yeah. It seems to me, too, when you smile, there has to be an object of your happiness. And if there's no object except for the wand of narcissism, which, by the way, I love and I'm going to keep forever, maybe that has something to do with it as well. So the future of the smile will keep smiling.
I hope so.
That's fabulous. Thank you so much for talking with us. Colin Jones is a historian. He is a professor at Queen Mary University of London and currently a fellow at the National Humanities Center. He's written a book called The Smile Revolution in 18th Century Paris, and he's going to give a talk tonight at the center at 5 o'clock. You can find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the story behind a secret basketball game in North Carolina in the 1940s. We'll talk about it on The State of Things. Please stay with us.